Well, it's good to see everyone. This morning, we're in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to read verses 21 and 22. I'd initially planned to speak on verses 21 through 26 this morning, but when I got into this, I saw that there was far more here than I could cover in one study. So we'll primarily focus on verses 21 and 22, and they read like this. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. I want to begin by pointing out a structure that is found here in Christ's sermon that's also found in the Sermon at Sinai. We've got the Sermon at Sinai and we've got the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon at Sinai is told back in the book of Exodus. And the structure of both sermons are fundamentally the same, and it's twofold. Both sermons begin by saying that salvation is free, and then they continue by saying, but discipleship is costly. Salvation is free, discipleship is costly. Now here's how that's said in the Old Testament, the Sermon at Sinai. Exodus chapter 20 is the chapter that has the Ten Commandments, but there's a verse before the first commandment. The first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. But there's a verse in Exodus 20 before that verse that we dare not skip over. Here's what it says. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And what God is talking about is His ransoming and His redemption of Israel from slavery. And those are the words that are used. God ransomed Israel. He redeemed Israel. And those were acts of grace. And then following God's reminder of what He had done to get them out of slavery, He then gives them Ten Commandments, and many more than that actually, telling them how they are to live as free men, not as slaves. So the Sermon at Sinai begins with a statement of grace that is then followed by the conditions of salvation, the conditions of discipleship. We've got the same format here in Matthew chapter 5. The Sermon on the Mount begins with that section we call the Beatitudes, the qualities of character. And one of the blessings, not earnings, but one of the blessings in the Beatitude is that they who are lowly in spirit and they who are persecuted for Christ's sake shall be given the kingdom of heaven. They don't do anything to earn it. They are simply given it as a blessing. That speaks of grace. Now, there are two words in the Bible. These are favorite words of the Apostle Paul that describes being saved freely and that describes the costliness of discipleship. And those two words are justification and sanctification. When Paul in the book of Romans talks about being justified, he's talking about becoming a Christian. We become Christians by grace, by God's free favor. But when he talks about sanctification, he's talking about living as a Christian. And that can be a very costly manner of life, as we're going to see. And so here at the start of Matthew, at the very start of Christ's official ministry, he talks about grace, becoming a Christian. He talks about discipleship, living like a Christian. And at the very end of the book of Matthew, he tells his 12 apostles to go into all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. Baptizing will make them a Christian. That's by grace. But then you teach them to live like a Christian. That's talking about discipleship. So both in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Sermon at Sinai, in the Great Commission, we have this twofold format of justification, becoming a child of God, sanctification, living like a child of God. Now, we've gotten past the Beatitudes, we've gotten past the two metaphors, salt of the earth, light of the world, and now we're starting to move into that section of the sermon where Christ is going to teach us how we need to live. Now, I want to remind us of what we looked at last week from verses 17 through 20. 17, 18, 19, and 20 are a preface to verses 21 and following. Remember I said last week that the law of Moses is comprised of three components. There is a ceremonial component to the law of Moses. There is a judicial component. And there is a moral component. Now, the ceremonial part of the law of Moses involved the temple and the priest and all of the sacrifices and the meaning and significance, the symbolism of all of that. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about the ceremonial part of the law of Moses. And then there were passages in the law of Moses that dealt with government, that dealt with the king, that dealt with the judges, that dealt with the trials and the courts. That's what I mean when I talk about the jurisdiction, the jurisprudence part of the justice part of the law of Moses. But then there's the great amount of material that talk about how a man ought to live. Christ said that he came to fulfill the ceremonial aspects of the law of Moses. That lamb they offered on the day of Pentecost of the first year without spot and blemish, that was a picture of Christ. When he died, he fulfilled what that Old Testament sacrifice at Passover was all about. Christ said virtually nothing in his teaching about government. It doesn't really matter to God if we live under a socialist government or a democracy or a republican form of government or a monarchy. That really doesn't matter to God because we can be a child of his and live like he wants us to live under any of those forms of government. But Christ talked a great deal. He talked about fulfilling all of the ceremonial symbolism of the Old Testament, but he talked a great deal about what it means to live as a child, about that moral element. So last week, verses 17 and 18, Christ is talking about himself and the law. Verse 19, he's talking about the Jews and the law. Verse 20, he's talking about disciples and the law. Here's what Jesus said about himself and the law. I did not come to destroy, I came to fulfill. The Jews got upset with Jesus because he was tearing down their little secular, irreligious playhouse. They had a good thing going for them. They didn't want anybody messing with that. And Christ came and tore that all up and they hated him for it. Christ said, but I didn't come to destroy the law of Moses. I came to fulfill it. He is our Passover. He is the last Adam, the last man. He is all that the symbols of the temple and the sacrificial system pointed to. He fulfilled all of that. He said, anybody who teaches that even one little dot in the law of Moses, one little flourish on a letter is not important, that man's got no place in the kingdom of heaven. He is least in the kingdom. Now, you Jews, you were teaching that men could ignore the law of Moses. You were teaching that there were some parts that are important you ought to pay attention to, but a lot of it you can just ignore and go about your own business. And I mentioned last week how the Jews, the rabbis, we're talking about the Jewish teachers, the rabbis, scribes, Pharisees, some priests, they took the commandment, thou shalt honor your father and your mother. And when they got finished with that, not only were you allowed to dishonor them, but in dishonoring them, the Jewish rabbis taught you were really keeping the law of God. That's what those Jewish teachers who claimed to uphold and honor the law really did with it. But then Jesus says this to us, verse 20. Except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. The Jews thought the scribes and the Pharisees were the top of the heap, pick of the pack, cream of the crop. They thought they were the kind of Jews that everybody needed to be. They were the model Jews. Christ said, no, you've got to do better than them. If you're going to go to heaven, your righteousness has got to exceed the kind of righteousness that they have. And what that meant was not anything legalistic. Christ wasn't saying that if they fast twice a week, you better fast at least three times a week. That isn't what he was saying. What Christ taught is that our obedience to him, living like a Christian, is to be motivated by love. It is love that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. They were only about law-keeping, rule-keeping. And they ignored a lot of the rule. If there was a rule they didn't like, they just ignored it. Explained it away. They gave people a loophole for not keeping it. But when you're motivated by love, you're going to go beyond the rules. You're going to fulfill obligations that nobody expects you to fulfill. When Mark Twain was 60 years old, he had a publishing company that went bankrupt. Now, it was set up like we set up companies today, LLCs, limited liability corporations. Your company can go bankrupt, but they can't take your personal property. You can distance yourself from your company. And Mark Twain was in something like that. He could have just walked away from his company's bankruptcy and never had to worry about it again. But that wasn't Mark Twain. Mark Twain had a sense of honor about him that he couldn't walk away from debts, money he owed people. And so at the age of 60, he took upon himself a 4-year worldwide speaking tour to raise the funds to pay back every creditor. The law did not require him to do that, but his sense of honor did. And love will require of us things that the law would never be able to enforce. And that's the righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. So that's the preface there in verses 17 through 20. And Christ now is starting a section in verse 21 where he's going to bring himself and the rabbis and us into the picture. And here's how he does it. Verse 21. You, and that's us. Christ is speaking to his audience. Everybody assembled there on the mountain listening to him. You have heard that it was said. Who was saying it? Why, your Jewish teachers, your Jewish rabbis. You have heard the rabbis say, you shall not murder. But I say unto you, and the I, of course, is Jesus. And so Christ says, here's what you've been taught growing up going to synagogue. Here's what you've heard. Here's what you believe. But I'm telling you, you weren't taught correctly. And you're going to have to change your beliefs about things. And Christ is going to say that several times over here in chapter 5. So we're going to look now at verses 21 and 22, where Christ talks about the sixth commandment. I'm going to ask you this question. I'm going to answer it before I finish this morning. Why does Christ start out his application in the Sermon on the Mount talking about the sixth commandment? He says, your righteousness has to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And let's think about that in regard to murder. Thou shalt not kill. That's the sixth commandment. Thou shalt not commit a murder. The sixth commandment did not prohibit going to war, going to a just war, killing in war. Did not prohibit the government putting a murderer to death, public execution. Like, didn't prohibit that. It prohibited murder, premeditated first degree murder. Why does Christ start with that? Now that's what we're going to look at and think about this morning. Well, let me begin by noticing some things about verses 21, 22. Dave, you okay? You need any help? Okay. Verses 21 and 22 again. Verse 21, Christ says, "Here's what you've heard." And he quotes God. You've heard something God said, but you've also heard something man said. What did God say that they had heard? "Thou shalt not kill," the sixth commandment. "Thou shalt not commit murder." God said that, and they heard that. But here's what man said: "Whoever murders shall be in danger of the judgment." Now, what does that mean? Well, sometimes people go to the police about somebody, and they tell the police, "This person's dangerous. I'm afraid this person is going to do something. The way they've been talking, they've been acting crazy. I'm afraid they're going to do something. You need to do something about it." And what did the police say? "Well, we can't do anything until they do something. We can't arrest them if they've not broken any law. But if you break a law, boy, we'll throw them in jail then, or we'll hold them accountable then." So Christ says, you Jews have heard two things. God says, "Thou shalt not kill." And if anybody does kill, if anybody does murder, he's going to face the full weight of the law. And nobody had any real problem with that. But there was a problem nevertheless. And Christ points that out in verse 22. What I have read, I'm trying to really nail this down, is that the way Jewish rabbis taught in the synagogue was this. They wouldn't do like Christ did in Luke 4 when he was handed a scroll of Isaiah and Christ rolled it and read, I'm here to proclaim glad tidings to set the... Christ just actually read the text. What I have read is that that's not what the Jewish rabbis did. They would take a passage, they would give a paraphrase of it. In that paraphrase, they would talk about the opinions of the elders, teachers, preachers in the past, Jewish teachers of the long ago. They would talk about their ideas and opinions about it. And then they might throw in their idea about it. And it was just kind of a mishmash of human opinion. That's how the rabbis taught in the synagogues. Christ says in verse 22, there is much more to murder than just the words, "Thou shalt not murder." You know why the devil beats us, defeats us more often than we defeat him? It's because he understands us better than we understand him. And Christ wants us to understand some things about the devil. And verse 22 is what I call an anatomy, or a dissection, if you want, of murder. There is a whole lot more to murder than simply wantonly taking somebody's life. And Christ talks about that here in verse 22. And what Christ is going to teach is that not only is the sin of murder, or the sin of fornication, or the sin of covetousness, or the other sins mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount, not only are those sins, but everything leading up to them is a sin. So what's the first step in the sin of murder? Christ says it's this: whoever is angry without a cause. Have you ever been angry for no real cause, real good cause? Does that sound rational to you? To be angry and there's no reason for you to be angry? Is it rational for a person to be jealous? Husbands and wives sometimes get jealous of one another, but they have no real basis for it. And they'll accuse the other of this or that, and the other says, "You're crazy. I'm not flirting with anybody. I'm not slipping around behind your back. I'm not doing any of those things. What's wrong with you?" Yeah, people can feel certain ways and get emotional about certain things, and there is no cause for it. And that's the first step in murder. Here's the first step in murder. It's to be irrational. It's to have an emotion, you're reacting to something, and there's no reason for you to be reacting to it. And when you're like that, when we are reacting to something and there is no basis for it, we have lost part of our humanity. That's where crimes and sins begin, when we lose a part of our humanity. It's not logical to be angry without a cause. Yet logic is a part of God. Logic is part of what God is. John chapter 1, the Word was in the beginning. And the Greek word translated word, in the beginning was the Word, is the Greek word logic. In fact, there are translations of the Bible that say, in the beginning, the world was created by logic. God was logic and logic was God. God is a rational being. He's not irrational. He's not crazy. When we become irrational, we have lost a part of our humanity. You know what the word Homo sapiens means? The man who thinks. And when a person reacts to something for which there is no cause, he's not thinking. Have you ever told someone, what in the world were you thinking? You've lost your wits. The word wit, that's a great Anglo-Saxon word. It refers to our mind, our intellect, our understanding. Keep your wits about you, we say. Let your mind control your reactions here. The sin of murder begins when we give up part of our humanity and we're acting not based on rational thought. Most murders are committed by people who aren't thinking. They've gotten enraged about something that has no basis in reality, no basis in fact. And in that rage that is disconnected from reality, they go out and kill somebody. Irrationality is the first step in murder. That leads to a second step. And that's in verse 22. Christ says, but whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of judgment. And whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Now those two statements, you say Raca to your brother, if you say to your brother, you're a fool, speak of contempt. These are statements of contempt. They are insults. When you say to a brother, Raca, you're attacking his head, his intellect. When you say to a brother, you fool, you're attacking his heart. When you tell someone, that's a Hebrew term that means brainless. Raca means you idiot. You don't have a brain in your head. When you say that to someone, you're attacking their humanity. When you say to another, you're a fool, you're attacking their humanity. You're saying about this person that they are worthless. That's what contempt is. Contempt is assigning worthlessness to an individual. And so you start out being angry for no good reason. Your anger causes you to look at somebody and say, you're not worth spit on the griddle. You don't amount to anything. You're worthless. When evil men are wanting to get rid of people who disagree with them, the first thing they do is to deprive them of their humanity. Lenin, when he took control in Russia, called his opponents insects. They're nothing but insects. When Hitler came to power in Germany, he called his opponents vermin, subhuman. It's a whole lot easier to squash a cockroach than to kill a human being. It's a whole lot easier to trap a mouse than to kill a human being. So what evil men do is reduce their enemies, their opponents, to subhuman creatures. Evil men have given up part of their humanity. They're not thinking. And in their non-thinking, they try to deprive other people of their humanity. Reka, you don't have a brain in your head. Now, there are examples of people being called brainless in the Bible. Christ told Pilate, "I came to bear witness to the truth." And Pilate says, "What is truth?" And Pilate's sneer, he was in his sarcasm. He said, "There's no truth, and you're stupid to think there is such an objective, concrete thing as truth." About Paul, they said, "Paul, much learning has made you mad. You've got your bucket too full. You're just talking crazy, Paul." Paul goes to Athens, and those philosophers, hearing what he had to say, called him a bird brain, a babbler in our versions. They were saying, "Reka," to him. You brainless guy, you don't know what you're talking about. And then to call someone a fool. You know, I have sat in Bible classes, I've listened to sermons where the point has been made, if you use the four-letter word, F-O-O-L, of someone, that you have sinned in using that word. That there was something inherently evil about the word fool. If you call anybody a fool, you have sinned. So what do we do when we quote Psalm 14:1? "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." What do we do with Galatians chapter 3? "O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you that you should not obey the truth?" The word fool is the Greek word moron. And here's an example of someone being called a fool in the Gospels. Christ goes to a dinner at the house of Simon the leper, and his good friend Mary comes out with a little alabaster jar that's got a year's worth salary of perfume in it. I don't know how much liquid was in the jar, but you would have had to pay nearly a year's salary to buy it. 300 denarii. And she breaks it and pours it on Christ's head. A year's salary down the drain, poured out on Christ. And there was Judas. He said, "What a waste." He might as well said, "Mary, you fool. You just poured out a year's worth of salary on the head of Jesus? Why, that money you could have gotten from selling that could have gone to a whole lot better uses than you put it to." The second stage in murder is that our irrationality leads to insults and leads to ill will, to where we say of a person, "You're worthless. You don't count." And once you've got a person in that place, to where they're worthless, they're no better than an insect, a cockroach, they're no better than a rat, it's pretty easy to get rid of them at that point, to do them in. It's going on all the time in our society right now. When they call our president Hitler, and I'm not sticking up for our president, I'm not making a political statement for our president, but I'm talking about people who regularly call him Hitler, call him a fascist, call him a pedophile, call him this, call him that. Hey, I wish somebody had taken Hitler out long before he took himself out. And there are people willing to step up, say, "I'll take Hitler out." And so what enemies do, what evil men do, is try to reduce their opponents to subhuman level. All because of their own evil. John, in 1 John 3, said, "Why did Cain kill Abel?" What did Abel do to justify Cain killing him? He did nothing. Cain killed Abel because Abel was innocent and Cain was evil. Now the Jewish rabbis weren't teaching that. They were saying, just don't kill somebody and, hey, you're okay. You've not murdered. Christ says, oh no. Everything that leads up to murder. Anger without cause is murder as a baby. You know, when a big dog's a little bitty puppy, he might look cute and cuddly. But that little dog grows into a big dog that can kill you. I read about two pit bulls killing a lady down in Florida this week, dragging her body through the street. I bet those big dogs were real cute when they were little. And anger without cause is that little puppy. But it's going to grow up, and it might become a killer. Christ says, every sin that leads up to murder is sin. That's why when we get talking about fornication, down in verse 27, is it verse 27 or verse 28? Whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery in his heart. That was the reason when I was a kid growing up, you didn't go to the prom. You didn't go to school dances. Because dancing could lead to lust. May not lead you to bed where you commit fornication, but if it leads to lust, that's a sin under the category, the heading of fornication. And so it's one of the sins you're not going to commit. Just like anger without cause is one of the places you're not going to go. In the kingdom of heaven, the little sins, the little puppy sins that can grow up into the big dog sins are as sinful as the big dog itself. Now next week, Lord willing, we'll look at verses 23 through 26. We've been talking about what our attitude and our thinking ought to be this morning, but next week we talk about the application of the attitude. And what we're going to see is that in the Sermon on the Mount, when we give ourselves to living like Christ teaches us, we're going to be uncomfortable at times, because next week Christ says there are times when we have to confront someone. I'm a coward. I don't like confronting people. But to be a disciple of Christ, there are times people have to be confronted. We're going to be unorthodox at times. Turn the other cheek. Who does that? There are going to be things that are unavoidable that lead us into sin. There are going to be things we're told to do that we'd look at and say, well, that isn't going to help. It's ineffective. Pluck it. If you got a problem with lust, pluck out your right eye. What about my left eye? So we're going to try to understand Christ's thinking in all these things he's going to teach us about.